The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panellists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on the programme.
The idea of having a more accessible platform.
One of the benefits of
the allows for
the crowd effect. This week, we unpack the theme of crowd urbanism, a concept that combines the best of crowdfunding in the world of tech and entrepreneurship and applies it to the urban environment. So can you create a more successful city if you ask the crowd? Join us over the next 30 minutes as we hear the success story of Madrid, how crowdfunding is being applied to real estate and local government, and even why one US mayor is taking all this with a pinch of salt. That's all coming up in the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to this week's episode of The Urbanist. We're reporting from a one-day conference that took place here in London earlier this week, organised by New Cities and Mistra Urban Futures. The event was called Crowdsourcing the City and was trying to answer one simple question. Should citizens ever be responsible for their cities? But before we get stuck into too many specific examples, John Rossant, chairman of New Cities, tells us what crowd urbanism actually is and why it matters.
New Cities Foundation looks a lot at the impact of technology on cities, on urbanism. And I think if you look at crowdsourcing and crowdfunding, it has been enabled by technologies, by digital media, etc. Naturally, we're interested. And I think we look in a very general way at the whole issue of governance in cities, the communication and the two-way communication between those who administer a city, the mayor, the city government, etc., and citizens. Crowdsourcing and crowdfunding can, if it's done well, make that conversation much more efficient, can make kind of local democracy much more vibrant and interesting, I think.
Now, we heard from the mayor of West Sacramento saying, okay, this is all great, but there are limitations on this. How big do you think those limitations are? Or do you think that actually we could see a whole new type of governance evolve where actually most of the money is allocated by the city?
I'm not sure I see that. I think there are limits to this. I think we have to probably rethink how our democracies work because, you know, one of the things about representative democracy is that you have representation for you. It's not direct. And this, you know, crowdfunding, crowdsourcing, it starts to go into direct democracy rather than representative democracy. So I think it needs actually a rethink, quite fundamental. But one of the things about representative democracy is that it allows for a reflective process of decision-making. Decisions aren't made in the heat of the moment. So one worry I would have is that this kind of direct crowdsourcing, people make decisions based on their emotions, based on the sort of things they've read that day, etc. And is that really so good? I don't know.
Okay, now that we have that covered, let's get into the nitty-gritty. How does crowdsourcing in a city actually work? We spoke with two CEOs to find out. First up, Eve Picker, founder and CEO of Small Change, a platform that wants to allow everyday people to invest in real estate projects, from smaller ones in your own neighbourhood to citywide initiatives. Here she is.
We are quite separate to City Hall. In fact, one of the benefits the developer would get is the fact that they could go to a planning meeting and show that a crowd has invested in them, which is a very positive thing to bring to a discussion about whether or not your project should go forward. So that's one benefit. The second benefit is, I think, in neighborhoods like the one I lived in for 20 years, where there was little of the right investment. There were a lot of slumlords that would sort of really milk buildings for profit, and they wouldn't really invest in them to make the neighborhood and the place better for people. So you have people who live there who really care about what's happening in that neighborhood, who can invest in that change. So they're investing in an asset that might do really well, but in any case, it's right next to where they live, so it's going to help their neighborhood one way or another. It's a little bit different than civic crowdfunding. These are developers who find an opportunity in a place and then are trying to find ways to finance it. And that's become very, very difficult in underserved neighborhoods in the United States. Very difficult.
Many cities, the developer is always seen as the bad guy and the bad woman. Yeah, the people who are kind of out to make a lot of money and don't have a real eye on the community. But you're presenting here a really different image of the role that many developers are now playing alongside crowdsourcing.
The interesting thing about being a developer is developers come from all walks of life. There isn't a school to be a developer, at least there wasn't when I became one. So, you know, I came into it with a very particular urban point of view, wanting to do projects that would make a difference at street level in the places where I developed. And I absolutely love taking vacant buildings and vacant sites and making something useful of them. There are other developers who wouldn't touch that. They will only do a big deal because it's not worth their time, and that's just fine. They all have a place, okay, big and little. What is the most joyful aspect of what I'm doing is when I started down this road, there were many people in the securities world who said, oh, there's going to be thousands of developers who are going to try to scam people. You're going to see there's going to be so much fraud. I haven't seen anything like that. We now have about 140 leads, and every one of them is different, interesting, and creative. They're just amazing. Everything from really seasoned developers who are trying to bring a different idea to fruition and can't get backing for it. They know what they're doing. They just cannot get a financial institution to help them to the level they need to be helped. To young developers who are trying to get a foothold, who can't raise quite enough equity to do it. We had a developer in Pittsburgh who is a pretty seasoned developer. He'd been working for a large firm. We branched off on his own, and the bank required him to have like 30% equity. It was a lot of money. He couldn't raise enough from family and friends, so we crowdsourced funds for him, and he was able to do that development, and it's performed very well. So that's another reason to do it, right? There's many different reasons. The developer in DC, he's very private, but I think he grew up on the edge of that neighborhood. He's an African-American developer. It's a very underserved neighborhood, and I think he has plenty of accredited investors, but he wanted to open the opportunity to neighbors. So I think people have all sorts of different motivations for doing it, and I find that fascinating.
But this is a model that's being adopted more and more by municipalities. According to Future Cities Catapult, 10% of councils across the UK are now using civic crowdfunding to shape their public spaces. One of the most used platforms is Spacehive, and we caught up with its CEO, Chris Gourlay.
We spend a lot of time trying to work with government bodies, local government, larger corporates, foundations and so on, who are interested in improving local places for whatever reason. You know, it could be because they have a responsibility for the local area, or they're interested in environmental projects, or, you know, they have different themes. And then we effectively wire those sources of funding into the platform. The idea being that if you're coming along with an idea to improve your local high street, you're going to be able to attract pledges of support, not just from local traders on that street and people in the area, but also these large grants to help you hit your funding target. I mean, the whole idea of doing these sorts of civic projects is that everyone needs to muck in together, government, local people, business, to make things happen. So we tried to design the technology to facilitate that.
Now, people may have noticed one or two of these initiatives in their community, but actually when you come here today, the scale of what's going on is what's really impressive. And certainly with Spacehive, you're a much bigger organisation than many people may think. You're involved in huge numbers of decisions. Could you just give us a bit of an idea about your reach within local government, within business and within the communities, about the number of things you're doing?
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, a lot of our projects are quite small in scale. So the average size is about £20,000, but you see quite large numbers of them. And I think for local government, the appeal of having a sort of platform or a model that allows this sort of activity to take place is just that it can be managed more efficiently than is currently the case. So we work with about 30 different municipalities, 30 different councils around the country to a greater or lesser extent. And they include places like Manchester City Council, Mayor of London, but also smaller areas like Doncaster or county councils like West Sussex. And we try to provide them with the platform that allows them to be involved in crowdsourcing civic projects, but also some advice and guidance and support to help them understand how to embrace the model and make the most out of it. But we certainly don't get involved in any of the funding decisions that they make. That's for them to decide, you know, what they want to support and why.
There's been a really interesting debate this morning as well about the limitations of this and the benefits as well on both sides. There have been people arguing that. Is there a risk that the kinds of people who learn how to use a platform like this are the people who are already kind of engaged with their community, maybe well organized, have a little bit of nous about how the system works? So is there a danger that while seen to be kind of bringing all the community, that actually smaller groups who are poorer, disorganized, don't have access to some of the roots of power, may not be able to know how to use you?
I think that's a really important question. I mean, we tried to focus really hard on breaking down those sorts of barriers. And I think, you know, coming back to the point we were making before, if you can create an experience where you've got a platform, it's quite easy actually for people to post ideas for projects to improve their local area, tap into support directly from the Mayor of London, directly from a larger corporate like Veolia who's interested in supporting your sorts of projects. Actually, those connections previously were really hard to have. You had to have the contacts. You had to understand how to go through a kind of quite bureaucratic grant-making process, which it tended to be the case that quite sharp-elbowed gamers of the system sometimes were really good at that, and actually they excluded a lot of other people. The idea of having a more accessible platform is that more people will be able to take the opportunity to start these projects and tap into those sorts of opportunities. It's not perfect, but we are, I think, lowering the barrier to entry for people so that they can make those connections and tap into that support. And I think you see that reflected in the stats. 80% of our projects come from areas which are classified as more deprived if you look at the index of multiple deprivation. So it's not the case that these sorts of ideas are gravitating towards wealthier, more affluent sort of areas. But I think the financial aspect of this, the ability to leverage limited funds, is something that does appeal to local authorities when they come to get involved in this sort of activity. But they quickly realize that there's a broader benefit to this in just creating an easy way to engage with communities, discover what local people really want and what sort of ideas have a strong mandate. And through that transparency, to make better decisions about how you spend public money. It facilitates a better quality conversation, I think. Wherever the state's responsibility for core spending ends and it shifts over time, there's always going to be an opportunity to the side of that to have collaboration between state and citizens and businesses made easy and not hard. And that's just the space that we're trying to open up and make more accessible.
We were pleased to find out that two of the panelists had very different takes on this question of citizen participation. While they both agreed that it is vital to include residents in the decision-making, they fail to reach a consensus on whether this is a fail-proof approach. One of the two panellists was Christopher Calbadon, the mayor for West Sacramento, and he said that while he is an advocate for crowdsourcing, people often make decisions that are not progressive or inclusive.
We're still learning what the limitations and promises are, so I think for me the biggest concern is that we leap too fast to what we're promising it can do. And it is exciting, and we're seeing some really important advances that are happening in communities just like mine all over the world. But whether or not it is a wholesale replacement for systems of democracy in our institutions, I'm skeptical, but I definitely think the jury's still out. You know, we ought to be testing and iterating. I helped lead an annual civic technology competition for U.S. mayors at South by Southwest every year. And what we've seen each year for the last 3 years is a declining number of finalists in our competition that are in the crowdsourcing space. And I think part of what's happening is that the bigger promises are either not attractive to cities, which is Madrid and several others aside. Most cities aren't looking for solutions that make themselves obsolete. But also, they haven't been able to deliver on the promise of substantial increases in trust or in ongoing sustainable civic engagement for progress.
There's also this question, and sure, not everyone's out there to see progress, but you gave the example actually for yourself personally as a gay man. You saw a vote happen that banned gay marriage where you live, and that was a crowdsourced decision in many ways, that we shouldn't always think this is going to come up with some amazing humanistic version of the world.
Yeah, I think that's probably the biggest danger in the way we've been thinking about crowdsourcing is that there is this mystical idea that, you know, if we get far enough to the bottom, that there is this highly moral, socially oriented view that can transcend engineering and politics and everything else to create a nirvana. You know, at least in the United States, that's not been our experience in the last 2 years. We've had dramatically higher levels of engagement, but not in a way that has pointed us to a higher social purpose. And it's true, when I was reelected in 2008, I was overwhelmingly reelected, and gay marriage was overwhelmingly banned at the same moment in my town. And it was just an example that you can have direct democracy that is not that progressive, even in a highly progressive place. And you can have people having different points of view in their own heads, the same person at the same time.
And you gave also this amazing example of actually you can vote for something now, even though your mind or your views on this will change over time, but we take a decision now and boom, again, complexity there.
Yeah, and it also inhibits our ability as a society to advance. I think one of the things voters in my city, when they vote for me, they say, look, I don't agree with most of what you do, but most of what you did turned out pretty good. And what they say they like is that I'm constantly feeding them things that push them to their edges, whether it's on social policy or environmental policy. But they're here for the journey as much as for their momentary opinion. And we remove the ability of government and democracy and politics in the best way to evolve ourselves when we treat our momentary animal instincts and opinions as though they are our permanent selves. And hopefully they never will be.
These are all the limitations, all the concerns, and I think really amazingly expressed. But even then, you do involve the community in these very crowdsourced ideas. Give us one or two examples of where you do actually go out to your audience and ask for their help.
We're doing this all over the place now in crowdsourcing because it's showing us how to get the democratic process better, but also it's just bringing to bear resources and talent and ideas that we didn't have and revealing things that government doesn't see or refuses to look at. And so we've been creating ways for citizens to go out and do things that are against the rules. And we've created frameworks for, okay, are you building a nuclear power plant? No. Is there going to be weapons-grade activities happening at this corner? No. Okay, well, within that band then, if you want to plant crops there and it wasn't allowed, go ahead. We won't enforce the law while we figure out whether this is a good thing or not. And so trying to create the space through our rulemaking to allow citizens in the crowd to be able to engage and build and create things that not only aren't in our plan, but we didn't even think we wanted until they happen. They're reversible, though. You know, they're not changing the city permanently. They allow people to be able to see and experience and touch how we might go into the future, but in real places delivered by their own neighbors. So we've seen real success in that space. And even on opinion, we're now measuring and looking at citizen sentiment in ways that we didn't before by spidering through tweets and Facebook posts and Nextdoor posts. And then using artificial intelligence to really pull out what are the trends, what's changing, and by specific demographic groups and neighborhoods to see and sense what people are already talking about, how they're already feeling, what they're already worried about, what they're excited about, without us asking them.
Isn't the risk on that, you talk about those social media platforms, that there's something that happens there is mostly bitter, angry, shouty, rude, unkind. And if you take that as the measure of how your city should respond and act, you could end up in some very dark spaces very quickly.
Yes, to some extent why we're using a much more formal and artificial intelligence driven process to do that. Because we already were paying attention to social media. We can't help it. We're social creatures, even in government. The planners, the police officers, the mayor, we're all social. So we pay attention to those often when we shouldn't be. Right, so we'll look at the comments. You know, if the city posts something about a new apartment building opening up, and if you look at the comments, there's 50 comments just absolutely angry about poor people and about vandalism and about slums. And as a human being, you don't notice that there are 7,000 likes on the post. And so part of what we're learning from this process is how to get better at understanding sentiment and seeing beyond what our human eyes look at. And we're also trying to pay attention, okay, how has it changed from last month? Because you're absolutely right. You know, the general tone of comments and that sort of thing does tend to be negative. But if we can see, is it more negative than last month? So paying attention to the delta and not just to the underlying phenomenon.
And arguing in favor was Miguel Arana Catania, Director of Citizen Participation for Madrid City Council. The city is a bit of a success story in crowdsourcing and fully enlists residents to determine how to spend 100 million euros of the metropolis's budget. Sounds great, doesn't it? Miguel explains.
In Madrid, we have a platform that is called Decide Madrid, where the citizens can take the most important decisions on the city. For example, we have part of the budget that is 100 million euros that every year they make proposals, they vote, and then we do the proposal that have more votes. Or they have citizen initiatives. They can propose whatever they want for the city, like to change the regulation or to put also more money on something, whatever. They also vote, and there are more people agree than disagree with the proposal. We do it. So we try to open as many channels as we can to let people to take really the decisions on the city council.
You had a new mayor a couple of years ago, and I'm presuming this is one of the changes that she wanted to bring in. Could you tell us how important it is to have that in place? Because Madrid was seen in the past as a city that was very top-down, very kind of unwilling in a way to listen to what its citizens wanted.
Yeah, this is something that actually is not happening only in Madrid. In the last local elections, all the big cities in Spain were changing the governments by new governments made by citizens. Citizens joined together, create citizen parties. And now we have mayors all over the country that are putting really focus on citizen participation. They think that is the most important thing they can do, that open institutions and let the people take control of it. And case of Madrid is one of them, but many, many, many cities are doing the same. And we are sharing this platform together between all the cities. And this is interesting because this is spreading also outside Spain. There are around 80 governments all over the world that are starting to share this platform and the methods and the process, and understanding that citizen participation is something good for them. So we're very happy with it.
So two little things. Do people make decisions that are generous to the whole city, or are they a little bit selfish about what they want? They want to get the money in their street, in their road, in their neighbourhood, rather than thinking about the big picture? How generous are people when they crowdsource ideas?
They're amazingly generous, and this is the great thing to discover. In the last participatory budget, for example, half of the decisions were about the environment. So were decisions that were not really about your street, your corner, were really about having a better environment in the whole city. And half of the decisions were about social issues, sometimes about really minorities of people, but they have problems like women who suffer gender violence or homeless or people with some kind of special disease or something. So we see that when we let the people take control of the money, they really invest on things that have a benefit for the whole community, and sometimes even for specific minorities or problems. It's the natural thing that happens because people are responsible of the money. They say, wow, it's a great responsibility on how I'm going to use this money. So I want to use it in a really good way.
Okay, say an idea comes up about the environment or making a park or something, and you've got the trained people sitting in City Hall or sitting around you. They say, look, I think this is going to be the best solution. And then the crowdsourcing says something different. When you kind of don't really believe in it, do you try and nudge the decision in a certain direction, or do you just say, oh my God, this I'm not sure, but let's have a go and do what they want?
No, it's very important that people have priorities, so they decide. It doesn't matter if we like the solution or not, because the government has the rest of the budget to implement their ideas of the best solution. So that part of the budget, that usually is a small part, it's not a huge part, should be totally decided by the citizens. This is very important because otherwise you totally break the system.
Finally, perhaps it's time for us all to shake some of our prejudices as we head to Moscow. You wouldn't be blamed, perhaps, if you scoffed at the thought of citizen participation there, but you'd be surprised to find out, as we did, that this is a tool actively used by cities all across Russia. Let's hear from Maxim Asayev, the head of digital production at Strelka KB.
There are different instruments, different tools and initiatives which we use and which we develop. And most often we combine offline instruments and online tools and platforms, because it's very important to have different approaches for different communities, for different scale of projects. And for example, in small Russian towns and provincial towns where we work everywhere in Russia. We have projects in big cities. We have a lot of different projects in small provincial towns. And as I've said, so every time you need to choose the right combination of tools. For example, in a small city which located not far from the Chinese border, Svobodny, where we develop master plan of the city right now. We came to this city and launched the crowdsourcing project because we needed to engage the citizens of Svobodny in the process of making the spatial strategy. And that was really tough to explain them that they are one of the core stakeholders of this project of how city should develop in one decade. Because in the places with underdeveloped economies, we got a lot of criticism and skepticism about such projects, these crowdsourcing projects. If you engage them, if you're being honest with them, if you start to explain what you're doing and why you're doing it, so we can reduce this level of criticism and people start to contribute.
But let's take that town as an example. So the citizens came up with some ideas about the things that they would like to see happen. Now, you're saying this is a city that is not a rich city that has funding questions and it has a local government. So you get the ideas. Then how difficult is it making them happen if it has to jump over those two hurdles to become successful?
That's a good question, because on the one hand, we help local governments to find the best initiatives from local citizens, which make the citizens the happiest. But on the other side, we are not pouring concrete and we are not responsible for final projects. We act like as a consultants, and our main goal is to deliver the best results, the best options for future projects, and explain which projects should be done in the situation when resources are limited. That's why always a situation when, for example, people want different things and you can't satisfy everyone. But you can understand what people really want and what their needs, and you can deliver it, this information for the governments.
And is it actually working, do you think, in Russian cities? Are these crowdsourced ideas being adopted, shaping how your cities are looking?
It works, of course. Sometimes it's difficult, and the thing is that the agenda of people engagement in this project, this is a kind of the federal government agenda. That's why we have this situation when, because governments spend a lot of money for making cities better places to live, a lot of funds go to improvement programs and projects. So we have this situation when local governments and authorities, they understand that they need to engage people in these initiatives, but they don't know how. And they don't get money for their projects if they won't engage their citizens in these initiatives. That's why there is no other way not to use these tools, and we do it and we help them, and this works. And we have a lot of examples of public spaces which are under construction right now in different cities, in different Russian regions, under construction process, because citizens wanted these projects to be accomplished. For example, we had this voting for the main street in every monotown because the government had funds to redevelop the streets. And we launched monotown's platform for these crowdsourcing activities. People vote for the main street in a particular city, and the opinion of citizens coincided with the opinion of governments. It was interesting to interact with these local governments because they wanted different places, different streets to be renovated. But they had to change their mind because, sorry guys, your citizens don't think so. So that's why it's a big deal, but it's working.
So while politicians and even some of us may get nervous at the thought of the crowd taking control, perhaps we should be more nervous of this, the sound of when the crowd goes silent. Well, that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Rabello and was edited by David Stevens. In fact, it was crowdsourced by them. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Dobie Gray with The In Crowd. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.